History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week marks another significant anniversary, one that a few decades ago was something the majority of Americans were aware of and recognized the significance of. In today's world, that percentage would undoubtedly be much lower, but maybe we can pump it up a bit over the next hour. I'm talking about VJ Day, Victory Over Japan Day, August 14th, 78 years ago this week. After 4 years of war for America and 6 years for the world, the most devastating and deadly conflict in human history saw hostilities come to an end, with Emperor Hirohito announcing his intent to surrender, something he would follow through on a couple of weeks later aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. But there's so much more to that story, and we'll hear some different perspectives on it today. If you were alive 78 years ago, perhaps you remember just how much the news of victory meant. It was certainly palpable in New York's Times Square, where NBC's Ben Grauer delivered some pretty picturesque play-by-play over some of these very same radio airwaves you may be tuned into right now.
This is the NBC mobile unit in the heart, center, and the pulsing focus of a joyous nation on Times Square in New York City. Ben Grauer reporting as I stand, literally stand, tiptoe, sticking my head outside the silver gray turret top of the NBC mobile unit and look uptown over a foaming, seething, writhing mass of faces lifted joyously and buoyantly and gloriously happy at the final conclusion of a desperate war which has seen its closing days in a desperate day or three or four of anxiety, turmoil, anticipation, doubt, fear, and being cast down. Are these people happy? That's the only word to express it.
They were happy in the States, but so many Americans were still overseas on VJ Day, including thousands and thousands who'd been preparing for the invasion of Japan. Among them, a former All-American swimmer at Yale who would go on to become the first Navy SEAL to reach the rank of admiral. Dick Lyon was a young frogman scouting out potential landing spots for invasion forces when the war came to a close.
Off we went to Japan, and I did another recon on a beach in a little city on Honshu, the big island, actually a village, really. Same thing, good beach. Having gone in, done the beach, and was ready to come out and be picked up by my LCVP, the Landing Craft, and get back onto the APA. And I noticed that the little city, as you might expect, right at the end of the war, little village looked deserted. I mean, really, nobody. And as I looked, I observed three men, elderly, I could tell, my face mask on top of my head by that point, and I'm looking. And they came right down to the edge of the water, and I'm in the water up to about my shoulders, and I looked at them, and they looked at me. The man in the middle said, "I can see what you have just completed doing, and I understand what is happening. It's easy to see that a small landing will take place, relatively small, and I presume that this is being done all over our homeland. I want you to know that we will cooperate in any way that we can to make this peaceful and help in any way that we can to be sure that there are no additional casualties of any kind. And would you please be sure to pass this word to your superiors so that they know that there will be no opposition whatsoever." And of course, I was just astounded that, wait a minute, all in perfect English, I thought. After a pause, I said, "I certainly will do that." And by the way, here in this little village, he kind of straightened up a little bit and he said, well, I must let you know, I achieved my undergraduate baccalaureate degree from Harvard University. I couldn't let that one go. And then I just paused for literally 5 or 10 seconds, saying nothing. And I just looked at him, didn't say anything. And then I said, well, I have to tell you, I'm a Yalie. And we used to kick Harvard butt regularly on the football field. We both laughed, and as it turned out, he invited me to join, he and his wife, and I ran it by my boss, who said, this is a golden opportunity for you. He, by all means, go in, have dinner with them, and enjoy. He said, in whatever way, I think he kind of is the leader of what's left in this little place, and we need that cooperation. So I did that, and I went in armed with 2 cartons of Lucky Strike cigarettes. They were more than gold bars. They were, and he was just delighted to receive those. And after dinner, I got back to get my way back on the APA. And as I was leaving, he said, I want you to have this. And he handed me a portfolio of 23 appliqué pictures, if you will, done by hand, appliqué, and then in the characters on the pictures, a story of how each of those persons became a samurai warrior. And so those samurai warriors are now adorning the wall behind me. You look right over my shoulder. You can see those, and I got those in 1945. My uniform was a pair of swim trunks and swim fins. Underwater demolition teams became known in the Navy as frogmen because with those swim fins on, why, you're the closest thing to looking like a frog as you could get. That was pretty much a face mask. I never went in the water without my K-bar, which is a knife, which was I had strapped on my lead belt. That's pretty much the uniform.
Another one of those things that has changed just a bit over the years. That was the late Admiral Dick Lyon. After he retired from the Navy, he entered politics, and for 8 years they called him mayor of Oceanside, California. For Jerry Yellen, the last fighter pilot is a moniker he often heard. That was the title of one of his books, focusing on the mission he flew in his P-51 Mustang on August 14, 1945. When he returned from that mission, the war was over, but one of his best friends, his wingman, Phil Schlomberg, had been killed in action. Yellen spent his final years as an outspoken advocate for the Spirit of 45 campaign, hoping that every year at this time, American leaders of the future might draw inspiration from accounts of the spirit of unity and shared belief that existed in our country back then.
My wish for the Spirit of 45 is to reach out to all the young people in America, to make our stories known of what made us the greatest generation. We served, 16 million of us served, 10% of the population, but the other 90% were at war also. We had an identifiable enemy. Japan was our enemy. Germany declared war on America. We never declared war on Germany, but that made the war, Germany and Japan. And after it was over, the leaders of America rebuilt Japan and rebuilt Germany so that we have allies of those who were formerly enemy. In 1988, my youngest son, a 4-son, married the daughter of a kamikaze pilot in Japan. And I have 3 Japanese grandchildren. They mean as much to me as my 3 American grandchildren.
When your son had proposed to his wife, she had to talk to her father because her father was a Japanese fighter pilot in World War II, right?
Yes, he was a kamikaze pilot. He had 4 or 5 hours in a zero, and his whole class of classmates, were sent into the war as kamikaze pilots, but he and one other guy were sent to China, and he survived the war. In 1983, I was asked by the Mitsui Bank Group to go to Japan, talk about real estate in America. I was a consultant to the major banks in San Diego and San Francisco. And I didn't want to go in 1983. Japan was not a place I visit, and Japanese weren't human beings. They weren't people. But my wife wanted to go, so we went to Japan. And I immediately fell in love with the culture, the food, the people. So when we came back in 1983, we offered a homestay program to our youngest son, who was a senior in college. He graduated from college in 1984, didn't know what he wanted to do, so he took a job teaching English for 1 year. Now it's 2014, and he hasn't come back yet. In 1987, we went to Japan, and I met a young lady, and Robert said that he wanted to get married to her. And I saw the faces of the 16 guys that were killed that I knew in my squadron. And I wondered what they would think, but it was not my life. It was his life that was important. And I asked him, what does her father say? And he said, he won't meet me. And 7 months later, the father did meet my son. And he had full beard, bushy hair. And the father asked him just 5 questions. How old is your father? 63. Was he in the war? Yes. What did he do? He was a pilot. What did he fly? He said, P-51s. He said, where? Over Japan. And he went home, said to his wife, make the wedding. And she said, why? We hate them. And he said, any man that could fly a P-51 against the Japanese and live must be a brave man. And I want the blood of that man to flow through the veins of our grandchildren. So I have 3 grandchildren in Japan. And we went there in September of 2012 to talk to them as adults. My oldest grandson's name is Kentaro. We call him Ken. And he has a job. He just graduated from the Hokkaido University, which is the technical school similar to MIT, as a physicist with a master's degree in physics, and was one of 20,000 applicants for 100 jobs. And he got one of the 100 jobs. His brother last year graduated from the University of City of London, a 4-year course in 3 years, as a philosopher, and the last 2 years of the school, he studied in Latin, which was the language spoken by the ancient philosophers. And when he graduated on the dean's list, got an A+ on his dissertation, and was awarded a 2-year master's program scholarship at Oxford. So he just started Oxford University. So I guess that other guy, the other father, knew something that I didn't know, and it happens to be right. It turned out he was right. And then I have a 17-year-old granddaughter. We don't know what she's going to do, but the 2 boys are absolutely outstanding.
But neither one of them would be here if both their grandfathers hadn't survived World War II.
That's true. I met, for the first time, a member of Phil Schlomberg's family. Phil Schlomberg was my wingman, who was killed on August 14, 1945, on the last mission flown over World War II.
And you guys were P-51s, and he was a good friend of yours and was flying on your wing, but he had somewhat of a premonition about that mission, didn't he?
So Schlumberger, we were briefing on August 13th, and somebody asked, why are we going there? They dropped 2 bombs, the war's over. And Jim Tapp was our then CO, and he said, we have to keep them honest. And Schlumberg leaned over and he said, Captain, if we go, I'm not coming back. And I looked at him and said, what are you talking about? He says, it's a feeling I have. So I told Tapp that story, and he said the only person to get him off is Doc Lewis, if Schlumberg agrees to go see him. And he didn't want to see him. He says, I'll go. On the morning of the 14th, I said, just stick on my wing. They're going to broadcast the code word Ohio before we ever get to the target. Nobody heard the code word. We got to where we have to drop our exterior tanks. We dropped the tanks. We went in and strafed airfields around Tokyo. We were getting shot at, I know, you could see the tracers, but when somebody had only 90 gallons of gas left, we needed 90 gallons to get back to Iwo Jima. They called in 90 gallons, and I'm leading a flight of 4, and I'm leading my flight of four through some clouds towards the B-29 that's going to navigate us back to Iwo Jima. When I came out of the clouds, Schlumberger was gone. There was no radio contact, no visible contact, and he was the last guy killed in World War II. While we were strafing Japan, they declared the war over, and it was 3 hours before we got back. So he was really the last man killed on a mission of hostility towards the Japanese on August 14, 1945. Phil Schlumberger graduated from university at the age of 16 and entered the Air Corps on his 18th, and he took the IQ test, and his IQ test was the highest ever scored of any of the 16 million of us that entered World War II. He was bright and brilliant and a good pilot, and he knew he was going to die, refused not to go and went and was killed.
One of more than 406,000 Americans who paid the ultimate price for the victory that was secured 78 years ago this week. Jerry Yellen was a fighter pilot in the air on VJ. Before we're done today, we'll hear from a pilot of the last bomber to drop its bombs on the last bombing mission of World War II. But when we come back, who could be more elated by news of the war's end than those who spent most of it in captivity? We'll get some POW perspectives on VJ Day when this special episode of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.